The season of Trinity, as we have seen over the last 3 weeks, is about our sanctification. And of course, that may not be a word that you go around talking about a lot, but we Latin scholars here at New Covenant know that sanctification means being made holy. That's literally what the word means, that we are conformed day by day to the image of Jesus by the power of God's Spirit, because God wants it that way. The Father wants us to be like His Son, and He's poured out His Spirit upon us to do exactly that, our sanctification, to be like God and to be with God as well. And so as I try to impress upon you on the first Sunday in Trinity, Christianity is simple, but it's hard. It's simple, but it's hard. Remember how it was that our epistle lesson that day was from John's first letter, when he told us at that point in our church year that this is all of our religion, that we should believe in the Son whom the Father has sent and to love our neighbors. That's it. Whole life lived in that two-headed truth, to love or to have faith or believe in the Son whom the Father has sent and to love our neighbor is as plain as can be, and yet is the most difficult thing that we can imagine. Lives lived in piety and devotion. The greatest of the saints, Abraham and David, Moses and the prophets, the apostles, and all that follow after, know what a great and glorious challenge this is, to be like Jesus, to seek Him in all things. And so last week, from Father Heaton's homily, we heard about God's pleasure in seeking the lost. We have from our gospel lesson, Luke, the 15th chapter, we talked about the three things that are lost: a lamb, a coin, and then a son. We did that one later, as Father Heaton reminded us, but nonetheless, three things that are lost, and how God is pleased when they are found. And then our response to God's coming and seeking us, which is to submit to God's will and also to submit to one another in humility. The theme, then, is our sanctification. And our sanctification is in seeking to be humble before the loving will of God. This week, our theme continues. Our sanctification in seeking glory, but not glory of this world, but the glory of the world that is coming upon us. For the glory of this world is one that we would call vainglory in good old King James language, but it would probably be better translated today as being proud or ambitious. That we're so easily tempted to think about this world like that bumper sticker that I have tried to remember all my life long as a lesson not to live by, which is, the one who dies with the most toys wins. That was what the bumper sticker says. The one who dies with the most toys wins. That is, of course, the wisdom of this world, vainglory. But our lessons today warn against that. Glory, which is the reward of the Christian and is the good and right object of Christians' desire, is not from this world, but is most certainly for this world. Paul begins our lesson today with these famous words: I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed for us. The comparison between the sufferings that he endured, and he is careful to give us laundry lists of all of his sufferings and so many of his letters to the church. He suffered greatly. very small in comparison to the glory that he expected at the hand of his master, Jesus. All of God's glory is set aside for those who love the Son. Glory isn't a word that we spend a lot of time talking about, unless, of course, you know, we have Independence Day and we talk about the glory of the Republic and the glorious marching bands and things like that. But glory is not really a word that we throw around a lot in everyday language. The Hebrew word for glory is heaviness. Something is heavy, right? Dude, that's so heavy. I think Mr. McCurley said that to me a couple times. It's so heavy, man. You lined it up. But glory is that maximum density that is God's. He's like the center of everything. He is the heaviest compared to all of the elements on the table of chemicals there. He, of the molecules, he is the heaviest of them all. Glory, heaviness, or density. It is the property which is God's. And his glory was revealed most especially in the Old Testament in the temple or tabernacle. But Paul says that God's glory now has not only been revealed in his Son, Jesus, who many thought was a criminal, and they nailed him to the cross, but weren't they surprised when he was raised on the third day? But now Paul says that glory now has been poured out on us who now believe in that resurrected Jesus. Those who have believed in Jesus now have God's glory, his spirit, his desires, his life, his freedom. All of those characteristics are the glory of God that have now been poured out upon those who believe in Jesus. But Paul goes further than that here in his letter to the Romans. He says that those who have that glory, those who seek that glory above the glory of this world, now have the opportunity to suffer along with Christ. Why? So that they might bring the world finally back from the power of darkness and death, of corruption. And so the world groans under that corruption, even as it groans to look forward to that moment in which God's sons and daughters will shine forth in glory. The whole world looks for God's glory to be revealed. His holiness, his justice, his creative power, all of these things are the goal and the anticipation of the world that is so dark and broken. And the church, those who believe in Jesus now, rejoice in that resurrection glory. But Jesus himself, in our gospel lesson today, warns against counterfeit glory. In Luke's gospel, he's challenging at every turn the world's idea of glory. In this chapter, the sixth chapter of Luke's gospel, he begins by talking about how it is that Jesus is the world's true king. And then he immediately turns around and begins to give his version of what we know as the Beatitudes. Now, our Bible students in here know that the Beatitudes technically are in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 5. But this is Luke's version, and he gives a shortened version of the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor, because they are the ones that are going to inherit the kingdom. Blessed are the hungry, because they're the ones that are actually going to get to eat. Blessed are those who are filled with grief, because they are actually the ones who are going to get to laugh. And those who enter and enjoy the glory of this present world will find themselves left out when God's glorious kingdom comes in. This is a very strange message that Jesus is giving. Taken on the face of it, it seems as though he's saying that the world, as we see it, in all its glory and power, is exactly upside down. the ones who seem to be out of glory are the ones who will be filled with God's glory when he comes in his loving justice. So Jesus goes on to say, if you don't want to find yourselves left out, then there are particular things that you should do to prepare yourselves for the kingdom coming. First of all, you should love your enemies. That's stupid. Why would you love them? They're the ones that are dragging you down. Oh, and don't forget to forgive the ones that offended you. And if you have someone that is under your thumb, you have power over them, be sure to be merciful to them. And if anybody owes you money and has not been able to make the payments, forgive them. Then, and only then, Jesus says, you can be sure that you will be ready when God's kingdom comes in glory. Now, if you judge others, then you can be sure that you'll be judged. So Jesus says, be sure that you don't, so that you won't be judged either. But instead, by refusing to judge, you can be sure that God won't judge you either. Now, this can't possibly be true. This sounds like such a topsy-turvy world that Jesus has described that we all know in our practical minds that this world would just simply fall apart. Worlds like that don't exist. How could Jesus possibly say something like that? Well, because he's describing the God that made the whole world to begin with. Think about it that way. What kind of God do you worship? What kind of God do you imagine the true God to be like? Jesus is saying that the true God is like that. Not a God who is constantly up in his heavens thundering down judgments and penalties, but a radical, loving God who's constantly looking for ways to find lost coins and lost sheep and lost children. That's who Jesus describes God to be like. The true God is the one who forgives. The true God is the one who shows mercy. The true God is the one who lets you punch him in the face and rip his clothes off and then nail him to the cross. You see, Jesus isn't just simply talking about God, but Jesus is also describing what he would go through on our behalf. Let the one who punches you on one side, you turn your cheek and let him punch you on the other side. You sit for our offenses. Let him who takes your coat, why don't you get in your shirt too? They divided my garments among them. Jesus isn't simply making some kind of arbitrary list about what kind of people we should be. He's making a very, very direct description of who God is and who he is as well, revealing that God to us. My friends, the glory that we seek is not the glory from this world, but it is most surely the glory for this world. The glory of God is the one that seeks to find the lost and to bring back the dead, to rebuild what we have torn down by our own greed and ambition, to bring those who are at the margins of our society and the limits of their own abilities, to bring them back into true life and to joy. Have you noticed how it is that the Christian life, as described in the New Testament, is mightily short of lists of rules to keep? Instead, the New Testament, especially, as I would say in Paul, is all about freedom that it comes from being made a new person in Jesus. It's as though God made us a new creature in his Son, gave us his Spirit, and then said, go for it. Go learn what it means to be like me. to live without anxiety about where your next meal will come from, without fear of who will oppress you, because we have all been made kings and queens and princesses and princes and kings. To not worry about where our inheritance will come from, because we have been given the whole world, as Paul says in Romans. That the freedom of the Christian life is about reaching out to the limits of what it means to be truly free and to be truly human. And this, my friends, is what it means to have God's glory. So John can say, don't be surprised when the world hates you. When they see you, say, I don't have all of those hang-ups that you pagans have been living under for so many centuries. I'm free because of what Jesus has done for me. Don't be surprised when the world hates you. Or, as Jesus says in the Gospel of John, they'll think that they're doing God a favor by persecuting and killing you. To be truly free, to be living the life that God has given us to live in this world that is so committed to death and violence, to overrunning our neighbors, is certainly a breath of air from another world. My friends, the hope of glory drives out fear because we have confidence that God has already begun this work and he will bring it to conclusion. The hope in glory drives out the love of this world because we know of the fact that the new world that is already broken in the life of Jesus now is driving out the power of death all around you. The hope of glory places upon us the burden of a world that does not know the Lord Jesus and does not seek him in all things. And yet, each one of us, in our own glory, that is, the glory of suffering with Jesus, now is the light that shines into this dark and dying world. That is our vocation. That is our ministry. That is our glory. Not the ambition of this world, the light of the resurrected Christ breaking into this world.